Welcome to the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Furthering the public's understanding of gambling and casinos with a mix of lectures and conversations available 24/7 to the world online.
Hello, today is August 5th, 2010. This is Dave Schwartz. I am doing a phone interview with Jack Harpster, who has written a book about William Cy Red called King of the Slots. So, Jack, good to have you here.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Okay, and first question I have for you is I'd like you to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your career and how you got to where you are today.
Okay. Went to the University of Wisconsin, graduated with a degree in journalism in 1959, and immediately stepped into the newspaper business. But it was not on the writing end of it. I started on the business side, and I spent the next 43 years in the business management side of the newspaper industry. I was with Copley Newspapers in Southern California for 27 years, and then with the Las Vegas Review-Journal for the next 16 years. When I retired in 2002, I was the executive director of advertising for the Review-Journal and the Las Vegas Sun, who, of course, are in a joint operating agreement, and also executive director of new media for the Stevens Media Group, the owners of the Review-Journal. And as I say, I retired then in 2002.
Mm-hmm. So why and how did you decide to start writing books after this long career in newspapers?
Well, you know, I had always had an interest in writing. That was why I went into journalism school, and I had always done a certain amount of writing. But once I got on the business side of things, most of my writing was limited to sales and marketing and promotional type things. And when I retired, I, like many newly retired people, I started casting about for, gee, what am I going to do to occupy my time now? I don't golf, I don't hunt, I don't fish, so I knew I was going to need something. I built ship models, but that was the only thing I had. The person can't do that 12, 14 hours a day. So I decided perhaps I'd look into the genealogy of my family, do a little bit of genealogy study, and I will tell you, I quickly got bored with that. You know, putting names and dates inside of little boxes isn't really the most exciting thing in the world. But in about 6 months of doing that, I did make a discovery that on my maternal grandmother was a family named Ogden. And it turns out that the first Ogden came to this country in 1641. And had some really marvelous contributions to early colonial America. Probably the greatest one was that he was the leading founder of the colony of New Jersey in 1665. And, you know, when I realized that my great-grandfather, nine generations back, founded one of the original 13 colonies, I really got excited about that. And I wanted to read a lot more about him. And I tried. I looked for books and journals and all of that. And truly, there was very, very little written about the man. And in kind of one of those naive, well, I'll fix that type of situations, I said, well, I'll write his biography, not having the foggiest idea whether I could do it or not. And I jumped in, made a couple of trips back to New Jersey and New York, where I did an awful lot of research and everything, and started writing the book and finished writing it. And after about nine, or well, I think it was a dozen rejections, I found a publisher for the book. It was Fairleigh Dickinson University Press, which is in New Jersey, and they were quite interested, so they published the book. And I guess I was more surprised than anything else that A, I had written a book, and B, I had found a publisher for it. A little bit of naivete there that, you know, when I got into it. I have since written five more. They've all been published. I write primarily for scholarly books for the academic market, even though I try to make them entertaining as well as informative, but I just kind of like the discipline of academic writing, you know, with the footnotes and the sources and all that kind of stuff. And I love getting my nose into, you know, into old dusty 200-year-old books and records and everything. And I truly enjoy both the research part and the writing part of this hobby. As I say, I've now written 6 books. They're all biographies. 2 are institutional biographies, and 4 of them are personal biographies. So that's what got me into it. It was really kind of accidental, and I found I enjoyed it. I found I did it well enough to, I'm not going to say to make it pay, because it certainly doesn't, particularly when you write for the academic market. There's not much money in it, but I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction out of the fact that I preserve history. Things that, you know, the life story of this ancestor of, or the ancestor, my great grandfather, it would never have been collected and known if I hadn't written it. So that's really the reward for this, is knowing you've preserved knowledge for future generations. If I got rich in the process, it would be wonderful, but I don't see it happening.
Yeah. So why did you decide to write about Cy-Red?
Well, my first 2 books were both about people from back east. The second book I wrote about was another member of the family tree I had discovered in that genealogy work, who is an extremely accomplished person named William B. Ogden, who was one of the leading founders of the city of Chicago back in the early 1800s, and was one of the nation's first pioneer railroad men. And again, same type of situation. That he had never had a biography written about him, and I decided that I would do that. So, again, a lot of trips back to New York, where he was born and spent the first 30 years of his life, and Chicago, of course. So, after I'd finished that book, I was getting a little older, and travel was getting more and more difficult. It was also getting more and more expensive, and I decided to kind of start casting about and seeing if there weren't local people and things that I could write about. Now, at this time, I was still down in Las Vegas, lived in Las Vegas from 86 until 2006, and I wrote a biography of Opportunity Village, an institutional biography about Opportunity Village down there in Las Vegas. Then moved up here 4 years ago and was looking, casting about for somebody to write about. And, of course, I knew Cy. I didn't know him personally, never met the man, but, I mean, I knew of him certainly from Las Vegas and from Reno, and I decided to do a book about Cy, and that's kind of what launched me on that project. He was close by, and I could do most of my research without a lot of travel, and turned out to be quite an interesting experience, because he was a fascinating fellow. So that's what put me on to Cy.
Well, you've got a lot of great information about his youth and his upbringing. So, you know, I don't want you to give away the whole book, but could you share a couple of things with people about how his upbringing shaped his career and, you know, what his early life was like?
First, I might mention that early on in this process, Cy had 2 children, 2 girls, and both were married, and one of his sons-in-law worked with him off and on for a number of years. He was an attorney. They lived back east in Florida, and early on, I talked to him, and they were quite interested in this project, so they cooperated with me and gave me, you know, steered me in an awful lot of the correct directions to go in. But as far as Cy's early life, yes, indeed. Cy was born in poverty. He was the son of sharecroppers, and he was born in Mississippi. Very, very little money. And he was raised in the Great Depression and really started his working life during the Depression. So I think the thing probably that shaped Cy more than anything else were these factors, and the fact that they taught him, you know, the virtues of hard work. More than anything else, you know, Cy was just an incredibly hard worker. Did not retire until he was in, you know, in his late 80s, and even then it was almost a forced retirement, because he just loved to work, and he loved to work hard. So I think that plus early on he discovered that he had a great gift for gab, and that was probably one of Cy's real strengths was his sales ability and his ability to talk. He was in his club speech club when he was in high school and just, you know, from the very, very beginning kind of developed that ability to communicate well. And I think those things really shaped his career from the beginning of his life.
Mm-hmm. So early on, he went into the coin-operated amusements business.
Yes.
Jukeboxes and pinball machines and all that. So what made him a success in that business?
Well, he started off with pinball machines when he was still in Mississippi and when he was still in junior college. He went into junior college after high school. Kind of got into that accidentally, and at first it was a case of good timing. This was the Depression, and coin operated amusement games were quite popular then, because for a couple of pennies or a nickel, people could forget their cares and worries for a while, you know, and the men could sit down in a bar and have a drink and spend a nickel or so playing these machines, and you know, so the timing was really good there. And Cy seemed to have an uncanny ability to know what people wanted, particularly in their amusements and everything. And he was just in the right place at the right time, time after time. And some of that was luck, and some of it was just that he had an eye for what people wanted, what people were ready for. And that plus this, you know, this sales and marketing genius that he developed over the years, I think made him successful in the coin-operated business, you know, at almost everything he tried. Now, that isn't to say he didn't have a lot of failures, because he did, and I guess we'll come to those in a few minutes, but, you know, those things coupled, once again, with this hard work, this work ethos that he had, always kind of kept him on the cutting edge of things.
Mm-hmm. So during his career, is it true that he had a couple of run-ins with the mob?
Yes, he did. He had built himself an amusement route business in Mississippi, and he was making, the figures escape me, but I think he was making about $50,000 a year, and this is profit, with roughly 1,200 amusement machines he had placed all over Mississippi, and this was in the middle of the Depression, so he was doing quite well. And all of a sudden, an outfit out of Birmingham came into Mississippi and started going into all of the same locations where he had his machines. He always felt that there was probably some mob behind this Birmingham, Alabama company, but he was never quite sure of it. I spoke to some people, historians in Alabama who were familiar with what Birmingham was like during that Depression period, and they said that yes, the mobs were quite active in Birmingham at the time. They couldn't, of course, specifically say whether these people who moved into Cy's territory were mob or not, but he always thought so.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, he then went up to Illinois and got some Wurlitzer jukebox route, ran those for a few years, and then was offered the opportunity by Wurlitzer jukeboxes to purchase the New England franchise for Wurlitzer jukeboxes. So he moved to Boston, and he was there for about 25 years in all. Made some money, lost some money, but after the Second World War, jukeboxes started to lose their popularity and everything, and he didn't come out of that quarter century in Boston really with a huge amount of success or a huge amount of money either. But he was kind of hanging in there, and one day some fellows walked into his office and said, "We're your new partners." And he quickly explained he didn't have partners, and they explained to him that they had bought one of his notes from the bank, and the note would be due in just a couple of weeks, and there was quite a lot of interest or vig put on top of it, and yes, they were his partners. So it's really a fascinating story from the book, listening to Cy's side of this about how he screwed up his courage and, you know, and went to Providence, Rhode Island, where the head of the New England branch of the Profaci family out of New York operated, and faced up to this guy and, you know, afterwards, however, got religion and decided maybe it wasn't the smartest thing in the world, and he did sell out to the Boston mob. So, you know, those, in addition to that, he had associations with an awful lot of people too who, you know, who were involved in mob activities and everything. I never saw anything, or no one ever told me anything specifically that tied him into any sort of mob activities or anything. But he did know a lot of people. I mean, the amusement machine business was just rife with gangsters, you know, throughout its entire history. And then when he went into the slot machine business, first off with Bally, you know, Bally was always in trouble for their association with the mob. So he rubbed shoulders with them pretty much throughout his entire career, but I don't think he himself was really ever directly involved in any sort of mob affiliations. I can say that with almost complete certainty, but it was certainly all around him.
Mm-hmm. So when and why did he decide to move to Nevada?
Well, this thing in Boston with the mafia buying him out happened in 1967, and he started casting about for something new to do, and he came up with an idea of going into the food business. The company Servomation had just started up then, and they were looking for people to go around the country and buy up sales routes for them, and he was thinking of maybe doing that. And he went to Chicago to see Bill O'Donnell, who was the president and part owner of Bally Manufacturing Company. They were friends because he had been representing Bally products, amusement machine products, for years and years, so the two men knew each other. And he went to Chicago and he laid out this Servomation opportunity for Bill O'Donnell, and, you know, to get his opinion on whether it would be a good opportunity or not. And I guess it was just a real serendipity for him, because it so happened that Bally had just come out with an entirely new generation of slot machines. Slot machines from 1899, when they were invented, up to 1965, the period we're talking about, were all mechanical, entirely mechanical machines. And Bally had just come up with the first electromechanical machines, kind of tying some electronics into the machines. And they had tried to get licensed in Nevada, which was the only place in the country, of course, with legal gaming at the time. And because of their mob affiliations, they weren't able to get licensed. So they set up a couple of distributorships, independent distributorships, one in southern Nevada, one in northern Nevada. One of those fellows was ready to cash out a couple of years later in 1967, and that was the distributorship for Northern Nevada that happened to be for sale. And O'Donnell tried to convince Cy to purchase that distributorship. So Cy visited Reno, was extremely impressed by it, was very excited by what he saw. He made a statement to something to the effect, I've been in the amusement machine business for 40 years and I never even knew this existed. You know, he just got so excited about the slot machine opportunities and everything that he accepted the job. So he came to Reno in 67 and started yet another career in the amusement machine business, but this time in slots.
So what was the Nevada gaming scene like in 1967-68?
Well, Nevada, of course, was still the only legal gaming jurisdiction in the country at the time, and it was extremely healthy at the time. The casino business itself was quite different then. Table games were king then, and the casinos, you know, put most of their time and energy into their table games. Slot machines, as far as most casino operators were concerned, were for the girlfriends and the wives of the, you know, of the blackjack players and the roulette players and the craps players, to sit and occupy themselves while the men folk played the big money. And that was kind of the situation that Cy got into when he first came here. And he also discovered that the machines were basically pretty much the same as they had always been, the slot machines were. And in jute boxes and pinballs and all the other amusement machines he had ever dealt with, he was a real proponent of something new. You constantly had to come out with something new to keep people interested, and slot machines just simply had not been doing that. So he saw it as a golden opportunity, really, you know, and once again, just like with pinball machines first and then jukeboxes second, with slot machines he got in at just the precise time where opportunity was the best, and he took full advantage of it. It was not too long after that Atlantic City opened gaming, and he was just in the right place at the right time.
So he comes out with Bally, but he doesn't stay there.
No, he ran Bally, the Bally Distributing Company. He bought 70% of the Bally Distributing Company, and Bill O'Donnell personally, in his own name, bought the other 30%. Mm-hmm. And then Cy ran the Bally Distributing Company for Bally, or for himself actually, but they sold all of the Bally products here. Mm-hmm. And he knew that eventually Bally was going to want to take this inside once they were able to get licensed. So there was never any question in his mind that this was a short-term opportunity, but he felt he could make a lot of money in it. And, you know, this was 67, so it was about 8 years before Bally was finally able to get licensed. And the story of how Bally then, you know, Bally and Cy began talking about Bally taking over, and you know, all of the ins and outs of this fight over how much money there would be to sell the distributorship and everything else. Really some interesting stories in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Cy, this was of course after some of the new electronic games were beginning to be developed, like video poker.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Cy bamboozled Bill O'Donnell and Bally into getting the rights to those games as part of these contract negotiations, just is really a fascinating story, and shows the man's genius. Now, how he ended up with the rights to video poker was the biggest one. So you know, it once again, hard work, being in the right place at the right time, and just being smart as could be, you know, is what made him succeed for the years when he ran Bally Distributing Company here in Reno. And then a few years after he started in Reno in 67, he also took over the Southern Nevada distributorship for Bally. So he had the entire state wrapped up. And I might say that when Cy started with the slot machine business here, Bally had about a 5% market share in slot machines in Nevada. And 8 years later, when, you know, after 8 years of running this company, they had about 97% share.
Wow.
So Cy did his job.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it was Cy's genius. Part of it, of course, was that Bally had a leg up with this new generation of slot machine.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a real sales job for Cy to get the casino owners to see that, because most of them were perfectly happy with the old-fashioned slot operations as they had always run them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was Cy's sales genius to make them realize, you know, that these new machines could be much more profitable for them, which they, of course, were.
Mm-hmm. So after Bally, he founds IGT.
Well, he had, while he was still working for Bally,
mm-hmm.
he had started buying a few little casinos himself for mm-hmm. his own portfolio,
mm-hmm.
and had started running some other businesses on the side, and one of them was called A1 Supply Company. And they started developing some little games of their own and everything, so that as he was leaving Bally, he put everything of his own personal enterprises into this A1 company.
Mm-hmm.
And that operated for a few years. Then they changed it to Circoma in the late 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And Circoma was the forerunner of IGT. And without the book in front of me, I think mm-hmm. it was 80 or 81, they renamed the company International Game Technology, or mm-hmm. IGT. And built that company initially, you know, completely on the back of video poker, which, he had the exclusive rights to for about a 5-year period. So that's really what kicked off IGT.
So what do you think his biggest innovation with IGT was?
Well, I, without a doubt, I think it was video poker. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any question about mm-hmm. that. Video poker just completely changed the face of not only slot floors, but of casino gaming's totally. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you know, Red was not an engineer. He didn't build video poker himself, but the people under him did, and he saw the potential of this from the very get-go. Bill O'Donnell did not see any potential in it. He approached Jay Sarno, one of the true geniuses in the business, with this, and Jay Sarno didn't see any possibility, you know, any possibilities for it. So none of these other guys, you know, saw anything in this video poker, and he just kept marching forward with it and seeing that it got developed properly and everything. And I think, without a doubt, that was his most important innovation.
Mm-hmm. Now, he also did some things besides IGT later, including Mesquite. Can you talk to us a little bit about his role in developing Mesquite?
Sure. First, before he went to Mesquite, he went to Mississippi and tried to get into the gambling ship business in Mississippi, and he lost about $21 million. He was the man behind, the man responsible for getting legalized gaming passed in Mississippi, however. So he's to be credited for that, which he is down there in Mississippi. But he lost a lot of money himself. But as far as Mesquite was concerned, he also was one of the very first people to see the possibilities of some of these outlying rural markets around Nevada. And he had purchased a truck stop in the early 70s in Mesquite and didn't do much with it, turned it over to the Pepper Mill Company who ran some casinos on the side for other people. And, you know, eventually first with Pepper Mill and then when Cy took over himself, they built this into a huge resort down there in Mesquite. And once again, Cy saw what few others had, there was a tremendous market in these outlying areas. And, he turned a little truck stop into this huge resort facility down there, and others followed him afterwards, and they built a couple of golf courses down there, and that was the beginning of it. I know Mesquite is suffering a little now, right along with all the other gaming properties, but I think it will come back, perhaps never quite as it was before, but it'll always be a good, you know, a good secondary gaming market, I believe, and Cy was the first man there.
Mm-hmm. So what was your biggest surprise in writing the book and researching the book? What did you learn that you didn't know before?
I guess I had always assumed. I go into every biography with a lot of assumptions, and I'm almost always proven wrong in a lot of them. I was familiar with the level of success that Cy had achieved and the wealth, the personal wealth that he built for himself and everything. So before getting into this, I assumed that Cy had all of the executive abilities that went along with, you know, with building and running a company like IGT, for instance. And, of course, what I found out was that he really didn't. Cy had a lot of failings, particularly in some of the executive abilities that are required to run a big, successful organization. Cy was primarily a salesman. He was one of the best salesmen ever, you know, and he was a great promoter. But IGT got too big too fast for him, and he got kind of lost in it. And and he became a little afraid too, because in the early 80s, after he had started it, there was a downturn in business, and he became a little frightened, and that's when he sold IGT out to Chuck Matheson and a bunch of other people. And he had gone public with it before selling it out, and that just wasn't, you know, Cy did not like being told what to do, as you are when you have a public company. So, as I say, you know, he was a great individual entrepreneur, but but he did not have those top-level executive abilities that I had thought he must have had in order to be as successful as he was. So I think that was probably the biggest surprise, and I don't mean to make that sound like he was any less of a success, because he certainly wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But, anyone who starts a company like IGT certainly has a lot of requisite skills for it, but they just weren't the skills to take IGT into the future.
Okay. So overall, what do you think Cyrad's legacy is for Nevada and for the gaming industry?
Well, Cy always said himself toward the end of his career that he wanted his legacy to be IGT. And that was one of his big fears, was that it was going to get away from him early on. And, of course, the job that Chuck Matheson and others after him have done with IGT, have turned it into the world's largest manufacturing of gaming equipment and software and everything. And Cy always wanted a legacy. He always wanted to leave a legacy behind him. And though IGT came very late in his career, he always felt that it had the potential of being his real legacy. And I have to agree with him that it has turned out to be that way. Mm-hmm. He founded the company that is now the largest manufacturer of gaming equipment in the, you know, in the world. And that's not a bad legacy. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think that is it.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of legacies, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, the same as I did with Cy, I cast about for somebody, you know, locally who I could write about, and I discovered somebody up here in Reno that's just turned out to be another fascinating study. It's a man named Levere Redfield, and he's not a famous man, and the name doesn't mean an awful lot out of northern Nevada, but he was a multimillionaire and one of the country's great eccentrics. He moved here in 1935 after having made many millions of dollars during the Depression as a stock investor, and got down here in the middle of the Depression and bought about 55,000 acres of land in the mountains between Reno and Lake Tahoe. So the man, you know, just made a whole pot full of money. But he was truly an extremely eccentric fellow, and his life was just littered with events that that made history, even or made news, let's say, even though no one knew much about him. His home was burglarized in 1952, and it was the largest burglary in the history of the United States up to that time. Originally, they thought it was $2.5 million it was stolen. It ended up being about $1.5 million, but in 1952, that was huge, and it eclipsed even the Brinks robbery, which happened a couple of years before. So that made news around the world, and Redfield was also a hoarder. He hoarded silver dollars. And when he passed away in 1974, he had 407,000 silver dollars squirreled away behind a false wall in his basement. And many of these were uncirculated silver dollars from back in the 1800s in the Carson City Mint, which, you know, coins that just have tremendous numismatic values now. Mm-hmm. So once again, you know, news all around the world about the Redfield hoard, and he just had, you know, one thing after another like that, that even though he claimed he wanted to be very private, just constantly brought him out into the public's view. And when he passed away, his wife's half of the estate, and then she got half the estate. She passed away in 81, and her money was turned into the Nell J. Redfield Foundation, which has, you know, is an extremely active foundation here in northern Nevada, and has so far, you know, poured more than $50 million into nonprofit grants up here. And, you know, so despite the fact that Redfield himself never left any money to charity, his wife's legacy has been one of, you know, just providing tremendous educational and cultural opportunities here in northern Nevada through her foundation. He's an interesting study, just like Cy was, although completely different. And you know, I'm probably 75% finished with that book, and after that, I just don't know, Dave. I'm just going to have to see what comes to mind next.
Great. Well, you've definitely written a great book with King of Slots. Again, the author is Jack Harpster. The book is King of Slots, William Cy Red. It's available at bookstores and on Amazon.com. We'll have a link up on the podcast page so you can buy the book at Amazon. Jack, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it very much.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Okay.
This has been the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Center, UNLV, its faculty, staff, or benefactors. For more information, please see us on the web at gaming.unlv.edu.